We were talking about particles in a theory with quantum mechanics, and we were working our way towards developing building blocks that would allow us to talk more explicitly about what it means for a quantum mechanical theory of particles to be Lorentz invariant. So I just want to pick up where we left off. So I ended with writing down the Lie algebra for the Poincaré group. All right, so let's talk about single particle states. Some of this may be review for you, or at least very familiar. Now, before we had, let me just to remind you, so Jane, you knew these were notation and boosts. These are the generators of rotations and boosts. P mu, these are the generators of translations. P naught identifies the Hamiltonian. Pi, these are space translations. Okay, this is time translation generator. Okay. So it should be familiar that we're going to want to identify single particle states as states that carry, it's useful to identify them as states that carry definite momentum. This is very close to what we see in the laboratory when we actually manipulate particles. Okay. Now, from the group structure, it's also possible to do that. All of the generators of time translation invariants, they're all mutually commuting, so we can all simultaneously diagonalize them. So we could talk about states that carry some label P, okay, and then some other labels that have well-defined momentum, okay, or the diagonalized momentum generator. So P sigma is a state with definite momentum. Now, what other labels can this state carry? Well, I wrote some index sigma here, just so that you know in advance, I'll be using things like sigma, sigma prime, sigma bar, etc. I'll use all sorts of labels like this when they're repeated. But this is just a stand-in for any other label that the particle can carry that Lorentz transformations are going to act on, right? You see that when I act by the state P mu, this state carries definite momentum. Right, and that's what this label signifies. And we'll see in a moment what these other labels can be. But I'm just going to assume for now that they're discrete and there's a finite number of them. But what other labels can go into this? Well, it's worth noting that P squared commutes with everything, commutes with boosts, rotations, etc. So that means that we can identify states that carry definite p squared, and that p squared is never changed when you boost, when you rotate, etc. Right? So we just identify this with the mass squared of a state. So we already know that all these little states are going to come with, in addition to carrying a p and sigma that we'll get to in a second, I'm going to suppress indices, but they're all going to have definite m squared, which just corresponds to the value of this generator on these states. But there's other labels. So another so-called Casimir, this is in group theoretic language is what we call it, that we can construct is obtained by considering what's known as the Polylebansky pseudovector. So let me just I'm not going to motivate the construction of this object But when we get to the little group, you'll see that, well, I'll make some comments about this when we get to the little group.
Question.
Yeah.
Could you just write down the name of that vector again?
Yeah. Other than iron. Oops.
You also have Pauil instead of Pauli.
Oops. Oh, that's just a typo. It's early. Okay. Anyway, it's the Pauli-Lebansky pseudovector. Okay. So it's a vector under Lorentz transformations, and it changes sign under parity. But the point, and again, let's not talk about the details of this, but W squared, just like P squared, commutes with boosts, et cetera. Okay, so this takes some definite value in all these particle states. Okay? So they also are going to carry some suppressed index W squared. Okay? Now, what you'll see a little later is that this W squared, this is actually related to spin in the case of massive particles and helicity in the case of massless particles. Okay, but just keep this in mind. Okay. All right, so that means that from last time when we consider, remember we had these are Lorentz and translations acting on the states. That's what these are operators that act on the states and perform Lorentz and space-time translations. So for example, working with these within this basis of states, if we don't perform any rotations or boosts, but we just translate, we should expect that this will just be familiar translation. Okay. All right, but now what is this going to be? All right. What are the options for the transformation rules of these states with well-defined momentum under Lorentz transformations, under the rotations and the boosts? Well, we can sort of figure this out, what the options are, by considering how what the momentum is of a state like this. Okay. So let's go ahead and let's consider U lambda on this state P sigma here. But now let's edit with a momentum operator. And I'll just insert the identity here. So this is equal to that. Now the momentum operator, we didn't derive this last time, but from the commutation relations of the Poincaré group, we know that the momentum operator transforms like a four vector under boosts and rotations. Right? So this is just lambda mu nu. E nu, acting on the state P sigma. Okay. But then we can just take this P into the state. And so this just becomes lambda mu nu, little p nu, right? U of lambda P sigma. All right, so this state also is an eigenvector of the momentum operator, so it carries well-defined momentum lambda p. So we already know the most general transformation rule then for a state like for rotations and boosts acting on these states is going to have to take the form of some rule like this, where at most what we can now do, we need to change the label P into lambda P, but then in principle there could be some non-trivial operation on the other indices. Okay. And what can that depend on? Well, it can depend on the Lorentz transformation, and it can depend on the momentum. Okay. Okay, but what can the what can the Z matrices be? What are the consistent options? That's a longer chalk here. Okay. Well, one way of getting a sort of useful and complete constraint on the allowed transformations on all the other labels can be obtained by considering rotations and boosts that leave this momentum label totally invariant. Okay, so in that case, so let's consider lambda such that lambda little p is p. Okay, now for these transformations, right, we know that the momentum label on the state's not going to change. So this will just go to a Z matrix acting on these. And here's the point. Because rotations and boosts form a group, all transformations that leave a given momentum invariant, the set of all those transformations form a group. It's a subgroup of the group of rotations and boosts. It's a subgroup of the Lorentz group. Okay? So let's say I have a lambda 1 and a lambda 2 that leave momentum invariant, right? That tells us that lambda 1 times lambda 2 is going to leave momentum invariant. Now we know from Lorentz actions that these operations are supposed to inherit that group property, right? So this is true. So that means that that the action on whatever other labels that these states carries also has to inherit some kind of group property. Okay, so how does that work? So let's just take these two operators, this one or this one, for Lorentz transformations that leave P invariant. Okay, and on the one hand we'll have, say, U lambda 1, the 2 acting on the state P sigma, right? This is just going to be P sigma double prime. Lambda 1 P times Z. Okay. But this also needs to just be the same thing as lambda 1, lambda 2. Acting on the state. Okay. So basically, this means that these matrices that act on all the other indices need to act like a representation of the group of transformations that leave P invariant. Okay. So there's a name for that set of transformations. The set of transformations that leave a given form momentum invariant is known as the little group of P. So I'll write that in a second, but let me finish writing this. The set of all lambda that leave P invariant is the little group of P. And for different P, that'll be some particular subgroup of the Lorentz transformations. Okay, but different P will single out different subgroups. Okay. And so Z, these Zs, must be representation matrices of the little group of P. Okay. So that's a highly non-trivial constraint on the allowed set of transformation rules that can act on whatever other indices these particles carry. Okay. Okay, so if we want to work out all of the possibilities for how particles transform under Lorentz transformations, we know that we just need to enumerate all of the different little groups for different reference momenta. That's fine. But now we can go ahead and use the Casimirs to classify how we do that, because we know that under rotations and boosts, they don't change. So there's going to be some definite label p squared, and there's going to be some label w squared, which will turn out to be the spin. That's going to be fixed. So we should just consider different cases for that, and then look at the little group for different states corresponding to different m squared or w squared. Okay, but so far this has just been, we've just been considering constraints in these transformation rules. Let's go ahead and actually build a set of states that transform in a given way for some particular choice of the little group. Okay, so this is a construction that goes back to Wigner in the 1930s. So let's pick a reference vector. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
The Z matrices, you they form a representation of a little group only when you restrict the lambdas to be such that it leaves the P invariant. Right?
Yes. I can't plug in some. This wouldn't even. This does not have any meaning if lambda doesn't leave P invariant. Well, by definition, you wouldn't get a consistent Lorentz transformation rule if that weren't the case. Okay, so we can pick a definite reference vector, and so k squared will have some definite value of m squared here. Okay, so we know we need to do two things to specify how states are going to transform under Lorentz transformations. We need to specify all the states that carry other four momenta p and a given label sigma. But we also need to specify how the sigma transform under the little group of a given four vector p. So we need sort of two things we need to specify. We need to specify p sigma, and then we also need to specify the action of Lorentz transformations on this sigma index. Okay. Now, starting from a given reference state, and again, this should be very intuitive what I'm about to do, because this is what we do in the laboratory all the time. We prepare states in like particular configurations, maybe using splitters to split off particular kinds of particles with a definite spin. Okay, but you know, usually there's some notion of a reference state in the laboratory. So this is actually fairly close to what we actually do in the lab to prepare particle states. But it suffices to specify states at other four momenta p. I need to give you one more piece of information here. Okay, for different types of reference vectors, we can connect these to a whole family of other four vectors. Okay, so let's go ahead and pick a procedure, or you know, this is known as a standard boost. LP, right, and this just takes K, our reference vector, to that four momentum. Okay. Now, of course, this is just a Lorentz transformation of one form or another, so it will, you know, P will inherit the same, will carry the same M squared. Okay, and then we can go ahead and define all of our states that carry four momentum p that can be connected to k in this fashion. We can just define this with some normalization factor to be Lorentz transformations for the standard boost acting on the state k. Okay.
So, do you just switch? Is L the same as lambda?
L is a particular lambda.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so we have to choose a particular type of boost that we're going to use, boost in rotation, that we're going to use to go from our reference vector to any other four momentum p. So the standard boost is this L of p. So what have we done? We've just chosen a reference state, and we've chosen a standard boost, and we've just defined all our other states, P sigma, to just be the Lorentz transformation operator acting on that K sigma. So this should just be thought of as a definition, okay? But we need one more piece of information. We need to know how little group transformations living inside the Lorentz group act on the sigma index, but we only need to actually specify that for the reference state, okay? So in particular, right, for any Lorentz transformation that leaves K invariant, okay. So now I'm going to use. So let me just call it W, mu nu. For any Lorentz transformation that leaves K invariant. We need to specify how these Lorentz transformations are going to act on this reference state. Okay, and now I'll use sort of what should be familiar notation if you're reading Weinberg or any number of other texts, these D matrices. Okay. This should be taken as a definition. So what am I supplying? To define all my particles, I'm picking a reference state, and that reference state carries these labels, sigma. I'm picking a particular representation of the little group that tells me how my reference state transforms into the little group. And then all my other states are just to be defined to be the standard boost acting on that reference state. Yeah.
So how come the labels sigma don't change there?
If I allowed the label sigma to change here, I'm allowed to do that. Because this only refers to a specific reference momentum, I can perform a similarity transformation to remove that Z matrix here, and just it becomes a similarity transformation in the D matrix here. I can move it over here. Okay, so I always have the freedom to rotate by a little group matrix once in defining these states. So I can always get rid of it over here. And just put it into my definition of what I mean by the D matrix. Okay. All right. Now, what I need to justify for you is that if you supply that information, you've now totally specified how these single particle states transform under Lorentz transformations. Okay, that's sort of what we were trying to do here. That was the point.
Question?
Yeah.
How do you specify NP?
Right now it's totally free. It's just a normalization factor. And we can choose it once we normalize. We'll make a convenient choice once we normalize the states, right? Because we're still in the process of building these states, okay? But now I want to convince you that you've got all the information you need to work out how these transformations act on any given state P sigma, right? So this is now just a matter of algebra. So just break this up. This was our standard boost acting on the reference state. Okay. Pull the normalization factor out. And now let's just multiply by a judicious choice of the identity. Okay. I'm just asserting the identity here. Okay. Now, note that the combination of a standard boost. Ooh, sorry. Please make the following correction. it doesn't much matter, but what I wanted to do was put in a standard boost to lambda p here. Okay? So please fix that on your notes. Sorry. Okay, so note. That this combination of transformations acting on K leaves K invariant, right? Because what does this do, right? K goes to P, goes to lambda P, and then we have an inverse standard boost of lambda P, which just takes it back to K, okay? So this, we'll just give it a name now. Controlled by the Lorentz transformation in P. This is in the little group of K. But we just totally specified how little group actions are supposed to act on these reference states. Okay. So let me just keep on here. Okay. So this is now. I can go ahead and use composition to pull all of this together. So this is now a little group action on the state, right? Well, we already specified how that's supposed to work. Right, so this is some little group matrix hitting this state. If you want, you can keep track of the lambda and the p here. Okay, but now this is just my operator acting on my reference state with the standard boost. So this is just by definition, this whole thing up to a normalization just brings me back to these states. Okay, so the point of all this is just to show how you go about building states that carry consistent or that transform consistently under Lorentz transformations. Once you specify the little group, you're good to go, up to a convention here in the normalization. Right? So this is the most general rule that we can write down. And then the last thing I should do to furnish a set of states that I can work with is normalize them and give them some inner product. So let's normalize our states. Okay, and for that we'll just use what a relativistically covariant normalization. So let's choose a normalization of these states, an inner product, right, that's just totally invariant under these Lorentz transformations. And let's make a choice of these normalization factors that allows us to do that. So we can actually just pick these normalization factors to be ones. We don't have to keep track of them. And now we'll normalize these states. OK, up to factors of 2 and pi. We'll just normalize them to be completely diagonal in all of these labels. All right, and now we're done. Now we have a nice set of single particle states that Lorentz transformations act on. Those transformations leave their inner product invariant. So this is a nice starting point for working with what we want to call particle states. Okay. Now, what are the options for choosing these matrices D, these little group matrices? Let's go ahead and just work out the little group in a couple of cases. Let me just do two examples. So the first, just good old familiar massive particles, things like things that we'll identify with states like the electron or pions, okay?
A question.
With positive energy, yeah.
So the normalization you chose, I mean, it's different from the usual one by a factor of 2, I think. I mean, normally you have the 2.
Yeah, whatever, up to factors of 2 and 2 pi and all that, yeah. Feel free to put in whatever factors of 2 and 2 pi you want there. That part doesn't matter. The main point I wanted to pick something that was invariant under Lorentz transformations, and that's why there's an energy factor there. Okay, so these are positive energy states with definite mass. All right, so let's pick a reference vector that has this property. So one reference vector, a convenient choice of reference vector, is something that's just a particle that's got mass in its rest state, right? So that's simple. So what are the set of Lorentz transformations that leave this vector invariant? Well, it's pretty easy just to guess the answer. It's all the rotations, right? You can just rotate spatially and you leave that vector totally invariant. Okay. So the little group, by the way, I'm going to just start calling this LG. I'm getting tired of writing little group. So the LG in this case is just SO3. Okay? Now we know what the representations, you should know what the representations of SO3 are. Right? These are just the spin representations with integer or half integer spin. Okay. And so SO3. You may recall SO3 has a Casimir, J squared. Okay. And remember at the beginning I said that the Poincaré group has two Casimirs, right? It has P squared and then it's got W squared. So you look at the little group here and it's got a Casimir, so this has probably got to have something to do with W squared. And if you work it out, this W squared turns out to be minus squared J squared. Okay, I'm taking this as just a dot product of a three vector J. Okay, so basically, the d sigma matrices, I could just put a little label J here, are just spin J representation matrices. For J equals 0, half, 1, etc. And they have 2j plus 1 components. Right? So these sigma, so when we write states, when we wrote these reference states sigma, so now we would say there's an m squared, and now there's a spin that we should attach to these. This is the w squared. This is the thing that characterizes w squared. Right? So the sigma just runs from minus j up to j. OK. So we just see that the only consistent set of transformation rules that you can ascribe to a particle with definite momentum that's massive is that the only other way that these labels can transform is though they're in the spin representation of SO3. Okay, well this is super familiar. We know that there are certainly that all the particles we see in nature that are massive have that property. They're either totally invariant under rotations, or they can be characterized with an intrinsic spin label. So that's good. All right, so what about the massless case? This is case where it's 0, not greater than 0. So a reference vector for this case would just be let's call it E. Okay. Just pick some vector moving along the z direction that's null. Okay. Now, this, by looking at this reference vector, you see there's one obvious transformation that leaves it invariant, which is there's rotations about the axis of the direction that the particle that four vector is moving in. So if it's pointed along the z-axis, you can rotate about the z-axis. You don't change that reference vector. So there's at least an SO2. But actually, there's two other sets of transformations you can apply. You can take that null vector and you can boost it, say, along the x direction, and then you can perform a rotation along the y direction to bring it back. Okay? And there's two sets of those that leave it invariant. So actually, the little group turns out to have the structure of the Euclidean group in two dimensions. Okay? So this is just, call this E2. So this has, you know, two translations and then one rotation. I'm talking about the group structure now. Okay. Now, there's sort of a difficulty here. Whereas all the representations here appear to pair up with particles like we know, like we see them behaving in the massive case. There doesn't appear to be any evidence that massless particles carry the labels that you would need to fill out representations where all of the actions of the little group act non-trivially on the state. And in particular, if translations of the little group act non-trivially, the particle would have to carry something akin to a continuous label. Okay. So we're going to take the route that the translations act completely trivially on states, and we're going to just work with representations for the SO2 part of the little group. This is a choice. So we're only going to consider states that transform under the SO2. Okay, so now I'm not being completely general. I'm definitely making a specific choice here. Okay? And in this case, well, we know what the representations of SO2 are. This is just a, you know, a nice simple abelian group. So we can represent those D matrices with phases. Okay? So the D matrices in this case, I'll use lambda now. These are just diagonal in this label lambda. There's just some overall rotation living inside this little group. And I'll skip this part of the derivation. But for topological reasons, we can only consistently choose integer or half integer for these lambdas. Okay. So lambda can be 0, a half, plus minus a half, plus minus 1, etc. So these are known as helicity representations. And as far as we can tell, this looks like a great candidate object to describe things like massless photons, right? They appear to have definite transverse polarizations. Transverse polarization, well, they can be given helicity plus 1 or minus 1, which essentially tells you how the state rotates, how the state rephases when you rotate about the direction that it's moving in. Okay. Okay, so these are the options we're going to work with. Now there are others, but let me just skip over that.
Question?
Yeah.
The other choice that you ignored, is there physical interpretation of those, or are they physical?
Well, maybe on Monday when we get to this, when we're talking about massless particles, enforcing that the translations act trivially on the state will force us to introduce something like gauge invariance when we describe massive particles that carry helicity 1 or higher. Okay? I'll come back to that. It won't quite force us, but if we want to build the most general theory of massless helicity 1 theory of states, we'll have to deal with those translations. Okay. Now before we get started, I mean I sort of alluded last time to the fact that we would need multiparticle states. I mean, we know from experiments we should be able to describe multiparticle scattering. So let's go ahead and just introduce those. It's pretty simple. I want to emphasize, there's no physics here yet, right? This is all just kinematics. We're just introducing convenient building blocks that can describe particles that transform nicely into the Lorentz group. But I have yet to introduce any dynamics. So So we're almost there, okay? So what about multi-particle states? Okay, so they'll just carry n copies, whatever these states are, they should carry n copies of the p sigma labels. Okay? And we'll go further and say that they should transform like direct products of the single particle states. Okay? So we're going to say that these states, p1, sigma1, I'm just giving them a name here. Have the property. That under Lorentz transformations, these will just act like the direct product of single particle states. So they'll go to lambda p1, sigma 1 prime, lambda pn, sigma n prime. And now there'll be some product of these d matrices. Okay? So this is w of lambda p1, right? That's one little group element, depends on p1. There's but this d matrix depends on the other momentum, p2, so these are not the same d matrices up to ci, up to the nth particle. Okay. And again, this should be taken as a definition. This is what we mean by multiparticle, by Lorentz transformations acting on multiparticle states. I have to tell you how to normalize these. But before I tell you how to normalize these states, we should consider what happens where two of the particles in here don't carry any labels that can distinguish them. Okay? Because it immediately, I mean, you know, so for example, what do you do if you have two particles here? How is this state related to a state where instead we have just two particles interchanged? Okay. So how is this state related to this state? Now, if there were some label that allowed you to tell them apart, they could be totally independent, non-trivially related. Yeah?
You have p1 sigma 1, p2 sigma 2, and then you have p2 sigma 2, p1.
Yeah, sorry. Thanks. Okay. Now, so far we're assuming, now we're in four dimensions, which is important for this argument. But so far I'm assuming that these sigma labels are just discrete indices with a finite number of terms in them. So it'll turn out that I could try, I know that these states should be related to one another because they describe the same particle content. So the only freedom I've got here is in choosing a phase. Okay, there's some phase I could choose. Now, there's nothing that's dimensionless that I can build out of these Lorentz, out of the Lorentz invariants involving those two particles that phase could depend on. I could conceivably try to make it depend on the indices. But if I did that, these phases would actually furnish a representation, a continuous representation of the Z2 group. And of course, when I recognize that, I see that the only consistent possibilities for that are ascribing plus or minus 1 to this interchange. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't have erased that and just say that this is the only choice that's consistent with all the transformation rules that I've given you thus far. Okay. Yeah.
Could you repeat why you consider Z2 and why it gives you plus or minus?
The problem here is if I interchange twice, I get back to the same state, right? OK, is that clear?
Yeah.
Now, so far, these are just the only, yeah, go ahead.
But if we, the coefficient doesn't depend on P1 or C1 or something like that, when we change it to change those.
Well, the argument there is you could try to build some phase factor that depends non-trivially on that. You would still have this issue that you need to get back to the same state when you interchange twice. That's a little too quick. But even before that argument, try building a dimensionless phase factor out of the Lorentz invariants that just have P1 and P2 in them. That's non-trivial. You can do it, but. Well, not in a way that'll satisfy any sort of rule like this. Now, the story is a little bit different in two dimensions, but maybe we can come back to this later, but I want to get to normalizing these states, and then I want to tell you how we introduce dynamics. Okay, so the plus case is what, and I'm just giving you the definition now of what we mean by bosons and fermions, okay? All right, what I'm telling you is there's a freedom here. You're allowed to specify how the states, how these states behave under interchange of otherwise identical particles. Okay. All right, having done that, we can go ahead and normalize these states in a manner that's consistent with our single particle normalization. All right, so that's a little bit of a, might as well just write it down. Okay, so Pn. Okay, I'm going to drop all my 2π here. Maybe I'll bring them back later. You might want to work through some examples of this, but I'm going to use a notation where I'm summing over all permutations. So P is a permutation that acts on the 1 through n labels. Okay, so when I apply a permutation to this list, it just reorders the elements in the list. Okay. And so when my permutation interchanges fermions, I'll pick up a minus sign. Okay. But otherwise, I'm just going to have my energy factors here. So P1, delta 3, P1 prime, minus this permutation acting on the first state. Okay. And then Pn, 0, delta 3, Pn, xp, next state. Okay. Okay. And then there's a 2π cubed. As was pointed out, sometimes there's a factor of 2 put here. Okay, this is all convention dependent. But just for consistency, I'll put it over there. Okay. So far we've got now a set of multi-particle states. They're normalized. We know how Lorentz transformations act in them. So now we've got the kinematic building blocks to start talking about dynamics. Almost. Okay, there's one more thing that's worth pointing out here, which will be incredibly useful later on. Actually, sorry, let me keep this visible. Let's just start writing. And that is we can introduce annihilation and creation operators that allow us to essentially define these states relative to some configuration with no particles in it. Okay. Now, I think you've seen this construction in field theory, perhaps. This is just the construction of the Fock space using annihilation and creation operators. But the point I want to make is that the commutation and anti-commutation relation that you impose on these annihilation and creation operators, it's just a consequence of how we defined our states and, in particular, how we normalized them. That's it. Okay. So it just follows from that. So I'll just summarize. So we can introduce a state creation operator, call it AP sigma, and a vacuum state, which is something that's characterized by having no particles in it. So the single particle state is just this operator acting on the vacuum. Similarly, multi-particle states will just be some product. Acting on the multi-particle vacuum. So don't worry about that. Okay. And the normalization condition just imposed that for bosons, these operators satisfy familiar-looking commutation or anti-commutation relations that you may have seen in quantum mechanics when you studied the harmonic oscillator, for example. Okay. And can I use a shorthand? If I write minus and plus. This notation you've seen, minus is the commutator, plus is the anti-commutator. Okay? So that means the minus here, oh boy, not minus and interchange, but this is bosons. And plus is fermions. And that refers to that sign right there. Okay? Okay. Now we're done building our kinematic objects. But you know everything you need to know to perform computations now if I start to introduce operators that act on this space. Okay, you can express all those operators in terms of annihilation and creation operators. And then you can calculate any matrix element to your heart's delight. Okay? That's why we introduced all this machinery.
Question?
Yeah.
To build a state, you want sigma 1, B 2, sigma 2. Sorry. Do we act first by A dagger of sigma 1, B 1?
Well, okay, so we should make a. So in the case that they're bosons, it doesn't actually matter. If they're fermions, then those states differ by a minus sign. But we could make the convention in this definition that the object that carries the label P sigma here comes from a dagger operator that acts first. We're allowed to make that convention. Okay. Now, I'm not going to review quantum mechanics, okay? I just wanted to give you the building blocks that'll be useful for constructing field theory. But now I'm going to just write down objects that allow us to introduce dynamics. So let's talk about the S matrix. So I think the S matrix was discussed in your field theory courses. But essentially, one of the things that we like to compute and is clearly observable are things like scattering amplitudes. So this is controlled by the S matrix. So you prepare some set of states that are sort of widely separated and not interacting. They look like free states. You let them interact. And then when all the interactions are finished, at some point they may look like, then again, widely separated or non-interacting states that can again be described by free states. And you want to ask, well, what's the transition amplitude for those kinds of reactions to happen? Okay, so you've studied these things in quantum mechanics, where it's very clear. You know, you prepare in states coming in. There's some scattering potential, and then you compute the out states, and then you can compute amplitudes for the overlap of that out state with any state that you wish. Okay, and there's a very mature machinery for doing that, using the Hamiltonian in quantum mechanics. Okay? So let's go back to the time translation generator, P0. So this was our Hamiltonian. So there's some free piece, and then there's an interaction piece. Now, so in other words, so far I've been imagining, and I'm not even telling you how we isolate the free piece, but I've been imagining that we're constructing states that just transform in a non-interacting way, not worrying about the effects of interactions at long distance. But let's imagine that we can always separate our full time translation generator into a piece that makes states transform as though they're free, and then there's another piece, which is an interaction term. Okay? And we know in quantum mechanics that we can compute the S matrix, which relates in states to out states through scattering reactions, as, this is going to require a little bit of, I have to define all these things, as just some time-ordered product. Where this is just the time ordering operator. So for example, it just puts operators at the latest time to the left here. So there's a natural generalization to higher products of operators. Okay. So you see, this is just the interaction term in the Dirac picture. Again, I think this is, we learned this in quantum mechanics, but essentially, scattering amplitudes for some state, I'll just use some, this is common, just using the abbreviated notation, some state alpha to beta, where the state alpha is an in state that looks like a free particle state alpha, and the out state is a state that looks like a free particle state beta, this will just be a matrix element of this operator. Okay? So this is the transition amplitude. Okay, and the point is, by construction, this operator is unitary, okay? So our transition amplitudes will give us scattering probabilities that sum to 1. That's totally manifest in the Hamiltonian formalism here. The Hamiltonian is some time Hermitian time translation generator. So this is just guaranteed by construction. So right now, unitarity is totally manifest in our computation of these scattering amplitudes. But now what we need to do is build scattering amplitudes that are totally invariant if I take these in and out states and I perform a Lorentz transformation on them, okay? And that is going to impose non-trivial relations on the allowed set of interactions that I can introduce, okay? And now this is where all the power of a quantum mechanical particle theory that's boost invariant comes from. It's the constraints on these interaction Hamiltonians imposed by boost invariants. Okay, but I need to stop right now. So next time we'll pick up on trying to explore what those constraints are, and that will lead us fairly naturally to theories that look like field theories. We'll see that you need go ahead.
Yeah, so the time order product, this is for bosons that term?
This is just for any, this is for any operator O.
I mean, you have to have a minus sign if it is for fermions. I would have plus minus.
Well, at least, okay, sorry. At least in this definition, I'm only giving it for a bosonic operator, okay, as implied here. Okay. Okay, vint. I mean, later on, we're going to see that these things don't have
the second line where you have two operators two times.
Yeah, but these are operators. These aren't states. Okay?
No, but I mean, if it was a. Okay. It was an anti-commuting operator, then you would have a minus sign instead of a plus sign.
Yeah, and fermions, when you select the two operators that they create in fermions, what minus sign?
The Hamiltonian is usually a bosonic.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to decide if I need to actually specify that.
Do you think that
for this purpose, I'm just going to give the definition for a scalar for a boson operator. Let's not use the word scalars and fermions. Scalars and spin 1/2. Just for a boson operator, I'll give you this definition.
Okay. I can imagine something.
All right. Are there any other questions?
No, I can say.
Okay. Great.
No. But I'm in quantum mechanics. I'm thinking you could possibly do something. You know, quantum mechanics is putting it on the recommended.
Yeah.
No, I mean, no one did it before. It might be an interesting thing to do.
No.
Oh, not time.
The time has to be the same.
No.
Okay.